I feel like it's just so issue.
We'll call this meeting for Tuesday, April 2nd of the Labor and Industry Finance and Policy Committee. Representative Hill, did you get a chance to look at the minute?
Do you have any corrections?
I'll get them done quick before.
I've examined the minutes and I would move there.
Representative Hill moves the minutes from, I'm sure you get the date right, for March 26th. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Real quiet approval, but the minutes are approved. First bill on our agenda today is Representative Tabke's House File 4626. And I understand Representative Greenman is going to sub for him.
Am I going first?
You're going first. And I'll move that House File 4626 be laid over for possible inclusion. Members, Representative Greenman, if you want to explain the bill and then get your testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I am, as you said, here on behalf of Representative Tabke, who's still on vacation. So feel free to give him a little bit of tossing over that. But this leads me the opportunity to present a great bill, House File 4626, which is a bill that improves on our investment in Minnesota's border-to-border broadband by ensuring that the excavation work by broadband installers in and around utility corridors is done safely by qualified professionals and in line with our values of ensuring good family-sustaining jobs for Minnesotans. Expanding broadband access has been a big priority for the state. We've been talking about it and investing in it for a while. And that's why Minnesota is in the process of investing hundreds of millions of dollars, of state and federal dollars, in our broadband system. It's infrastructure that is vital to connecting families and businesses in every corridor and corner of our state. And to deliver that connectivity, these workers are installing fiber optic cables, often within inches of gas lines and utility lines in neighborhoods and communities across our state. And that's why it's so critical that we're getting the job done safely and right. But unfortunately, according to many contractors and workers, that's not what's happening in the broadband projects right now. So for everyone's safety and for our community's safety, we can and must do better. Unlike other government-supported and funded programs, current law exempts last-mile broadband projects from prevailing wage protections. This exempts most broadband projects in the state, about 75% of them. It undercuts wages and benefits of Minnesota workers, and moreover, it leads to higher turnover and less job experience that can create safety risks on the job. And unlike other safety and sensitive construction projects, broadband installers aren't required to comply with the same safety standards and training requirements as other workers doing similar types of work in the utility sector. As a result, we're seeing out-of-state contractors undercut local standards at the expense of Minnesota workers and the safety of our communities. This bill addresses that issue. It addresses the worker and community safety issues that result from our current law by doing two things. It protects Minnesota workers by applying Minnesota's prevailing wage standards to all broadband infrastructure. So what it does is it repeals the last mile exemption and ensures that all workers working on broadband projects that received government assistance receive a living wage. The bill also protects Minnesota communities by requiring broadband installers to follow the same safety guidelines that are already required for gas line workers. They're doing the same excavation work around dangerous gas and electric utilities and should follow the same safety laws to protect the safety of our communities when these projects are happening. There's no fiscal cost. You can check the fiscal note. The investment has already been made. It is a vital investment, and that's why we're all here. And it's one that needs to be done safely and to ensure that the workers and their families are earning a living wage. To be clear, nobody wants to slow down the process or scale back the projects that they're delivered, least of all the workers who are building and installing this critical infrastructure. This bill simply requires that government-supported projects adhere to the same rules as other government-supported projects that we fund in Minnesota, provide a prevailing wage and high-quality implementation by meeting the safety standards of similar jobs. As we invest millions, hundreds of millions of dollars, taxpayers should be confident that this infrastructure is delivered by highly skilled workers and in the safest possible conditions. With that, Mr. Chair, I think we have Jason, George, and a few other testifiers.
Thank you, ma'am. We have testifiers. Jason George is the first on my list. And members, in your packet, there's also letters of testimony on this bill, so take a look at those. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jason George. I'm the elected business manager of the Operating Engineers Local 49. We are the state's largest construction union, 15,000 members, operate equipment, maintain equipment throughout the state. Thanks for your time. Thanks for hearing this bill. Thanks for Representative Greenman for pinch hitting for the vacationing, Brad Tapke. Make sure you guys give him some stuff, right? We did good on that. I want to just talk about, Representative Greenman laid it out well. I have some stuff to add. Why we're here and why we're bringing this forward with Representative Tackey's support is that we've seen some stuff on the ground that's been a little bit disturbing. I have organizers and agents that full-time work in this industry, natural gas, broadband, oil pipelines. They've visited hundreds of job sites across the state on broadband job sites. And they've talked to workers who are putting this in, and these are non-union sites. We visit our own people too, but these are non-union sites. What they're finding is that the average operator is making $18 to $20 an hour with no benefits. They're also finding that they don't know who these contractors are or where they're from, and the workers aren't from here either. So that is not the case for every non-union project that we run into, but that's the case for too many. So, you know, that's our concern. And that's happening right now at a low investment level from the state. So what we're here to do is to try to bring some more regulation. As you're talking about investing $500 million or more into this industry, we feel like it needs a little bit more regulation and some safety guards to help make sure that those dollars, those taxpayer dollars, benefit local workers in your local communities and not are shipped out of state to low-wage contractors from Texas or wherever. So the two components of the bill that we brought forward, we think are pretty simple, and we tried to keep it simple. The equipment operators in the natural gas industry, which is the same corridors that broadband is being placed in, have requirements. All of our contractors, and it's 99% union in the natural gas industry, maybe 100% for operators. We don't know of any non-union players in that space. All of our contractors require each operator to get OQ training every year, equipment operator training, updated every year. They have to do that. They have to have that certification to operate equipment on their jobs. They also have to have a health card that requires drug screening, drug testing every year on their jobs. That is not happening in the broadband industry right now. We'd like to see that happen. They're digging right along these lines. It just makes common sense to us. Union or non-union, by the way, everybody. The second piece of this is prevailing wage, as Representative Greenman laid out. Every industry that spends hundreds of millions of taxpayer dollars in this state has prevailing wage requirements on it. It's tried and true. It's tested. It's a good system. It works. It creates area wage standards, different standards, by the way, for different regions of the state. This is not all the metro wage. That's kind of a misnomer that gets spread around. And it works very well. And it's submitted, you know, the surveys are submitted by area contractors from their area. Wages are set. Local contractors, both union and non-union, by the way, are protected from out-of-state contractors coming in here and lowballing them on wages and getting bids. So we're trying to, as Representative Greenman pointed out, 74% of the projects let by deed so far have been deemed final mile. We think there's some manipulation going on with the definition of final mile. It's hard for us to believe that that many projects are final mile. That doesn't make a lot of sense to us. We think there's some, you know, some stuff going on to try to get around prevailing wage requirements, quite frankly. So. Some of the things you'll hear in opposition to this, we've heard in previous committees, it'll increase costs by 30% for broadband, so we won't be able to build broadband. I'm not good at math, but I can tell you that the cost of a project, the labor cost on one of these broadband projects from we have a dozen contractors that put this in every day. I got two people sitting right there who've done this for a living. The cost is 25%. the labor costs on one of these projects. So if you're going to, paying prevailing wages is going to increase the total project cost 30%, they must be paying $8 an hour, right? Like, the math doesn't work there. There's no way that you could increase wages a little bit and tell me that the overall cost of the project's going to increase 30%. Doesn't make sense, quite honestly. You'll also hear other testifiers, I'm sure. Whenever you bring up prevailing wages, the chairman's very familiar with over the years, you're going to hear the sky will fall if we do prevailing wage. So just be prepared for that. We've had that discussion. Prevailing wage enjoys bipartisan support in this legislature. There's many Republican friends that I have that support prevailing wage in this legislature. Three of the four Republican members of Congress in this state support prevailing wage. Okay, so this is a kind of a settled issue on that front. I don't have too much to add other than I want to make a note. We are talking to the industry. I think, you know, Republicans, Democrats alike understand that Local 49 has a good reputation of working with industry. We work with them a lot of different industries. And we want to do that here too. We don't want to do anything that's going to set the industry back, create all kinds of problems for the industry that isn't, that things that aren't doable, right? We want to make sure that we come to a solution that we can work on together and that makes sense. We feel like we brought some stuff forward. The industry's not there yet. They're still in opposition to the language as it sits right now, but we're having good conversations about this bill, about what we need to do to protect local contractors, both union and non-union. And we want those conversations to continue with the industry, and that's our pledge to do so. They've been very transparent. I'll give them credit. They've shared stuff with us, and we're having really good talks. So I want to make sure that I acknowledge that. And they get some credit here, too, for not just saying no. They are talking to us about what we can do. So I hope that laying this bill over is a good idea. It has some more work to do, no doubt. It's not perfect right now. We acknowledge that. But this is our best attempt to bring some clarity and regulation and safety to our local broadband industry here in Minnesota as it expands and attracts more national attention from out-of-state contractors that don't pay area standards. So thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you for your testimony. The next person I have on my list is Tom Hansen. And welcome to the committee, and you know the routine.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Tom Hansen, and I am here testifying on behalf of my client, the Minnesota Telecom Alliance. The MTA, if you don't know, is a membership as a mix of cooperatives, family-owned, privately held, and publicly traded broadband providers throughout the state of Minnesota. While MTA members have many different corporate structures, one thing they have in common is their commitment to serving Minnesota. I have just 3 points to make for you today. First, we still oppose the language as currently drafted, but as Mr. George has said, we've had significant conversations with the proponents and the authors of the bill. And I also want to add that MTA is very proud of their safety record. I wasn't going to think I had to say that, but they're very proud of it, and I don't think this is the role of to go through and talk about all that and who's right and who's wrong. But what we are committed to doing is working with the authors and the other stakeholders to come up with a bill that incentivizes participation. We want people to work, and we want to build out broadband. Incentivizes participation in state and federal programs, but does not put up roadblocks that will de-incentivize the providers who have successfully deployed broadband to some of the hardest to serve areas of our state. And then the final point, and something MTA has talked about for a while, getting a prevailing wage classifications for broadband employees for their specific employees. With that, Mr. Chair, thank you, and thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. The next person I have is John Twist. And after that, I have Melissa Wolf, if you can be ready. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. My name is John Twist. I am the CEO and General Manager of Arrowhead Cooperative, located almost entirely within Cook County, Minnesota. We're not for-profit cooperative serving our community with electricity and broadband. We were the first electric cooperative in the state to build a broadband network and have been fully operational for 10 years. We currently serve 4,500 members with electricity and 4,000 with subscribers with gigabit-capable broadband. So as a not-for-profit, we operate on very thin margins to ensure our members receive the best value for their dollar. Our experience in an extremely high-cost build area gives us unique insight into the economics of building and maintaining broadband infrastructure. This bill, as introduced, will add significant financial burden and create practical challenges that threaten the ability to provide affordable broadband access to the already struggling communities of rural Minnesota. Prevailing wage is standard practice for most government grant programs and already applies to state grants for middle-mile broadband infrastructure. The exemption for last-mile projects exists in recognition of nearly insurmountable costs of completing this part of broadband projects. Put simply, repealing this exemption will deter cooperatives and service providers from applying for these grants and threaten the goal of bringing broadband to all Minnesotans. This goal cannot be reached if we continue to reduce the number of households we actually connect with the limited grant dollars available. I also want to express our support for the improvements in safety and inspection rules in sections 1 and 2 of this bill. Nothing is more important to us than the safety of our workforce, and we support passing these additions and clarifications to ensure everyone's safety when working utility corridors. I respectfully urge you to preserve the existing exemption for last mile projects and allow the Office of Broadband Development to continue the successful model that has advanced broadband access and connectivity across our great state so we can finally fulfill our shared goal of closing the digital divide for every Minnesotan. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Melissa Wolf, and then I have John Beshe. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record. And proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Melissa Wolf, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Cable Communications Association. Sorry, this is falling a little bit here. Minnesota Cable represents cable companies who are proud to serve residents of Minnesota in every corner of the state, from Schaumburg's and Thief River Falls, SCI and Hinckley, to Midco and Fairmont. Collectively, Minnesota cable companies provide high-speed, reliable broadband connections to over 1.5 million residents in the metro, suburbs, and rural Minnesota. It is undeniable that access to a reliable, high-speed internet connection has become an essential service of modern society. The members of Minnesota Cable are proud of the role they have played in ensuring their customers have access to strong, dependable, and fast broadband, and we are proud of the continuing investments that we have made to bring these connections to areas of Minnesota that do not currently have it. We have been looking forward to, along with our industry partners that you've just heard from, finishing the job of achieving universal broadband service to all Minnesotans by 2026 in accordance with the statutory goals set by the legislature 8 years ago. Minnesota is in the home stretch in the race to achieve these goals with the help of $652 million in federal grant funding from the Broadband Equity Access and Deployment, or BEAD, program that has been made available. House File 4626, as introduced, will significantly harm the state of Minnesota's ability to expand broadband access under the state border-to-border and federal BEAD grant programs, adding more costs to participating providers and making it significantly more expensive to build networks. Recognizing the need for speed and to stretch BEAD funding as far as it can go to achieve the federal universal broadband mandate, Congress did not apply the Davis-Bacon Act or any other regulations in this bill to BEAD. For the same reasons, the Minnesota legislature hasn't imposed prevailing wage regulations or new regulations on state-funded last-mile broadband projects. In addition, the safety regulations proposed under House File 4626 are very problematic, as they incorporate federal regulations completely irrelevant to the broadband or telecommunications industry. A state law requiring broadband workers and other communication service workers to comply with federal regulations for training natural gas and liquefied natural gas workers would be akin to the legislature mandating that aviation mechanics be trained to fix tractors in order to be aviation mechanics. equally irrelevant is a requirement for broadband installers to comply with a highly regulated drug and alcohol testing regime designed by the United States Department of Transportation for airline pilots. We are committed to working with proponents of this bill, as everybody else has mentioned, and I just want to echo that we remain committed to working on these bills and finding compromise where we can. Still, we believe that instead of incentivizing private investment in Minnesota, House File 4626 creates new and expensive roadblocks and barriers to broadband expansion and deployment. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. John Beshe. And welcome to the committee. State your name and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Beshe, here on behalf of the Associated Builders and Contractors in Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to provide comment on House File 4626. ABC promotes fair and open competition in the construction industry in which anyone can succeed based on merit, and we believe that work opportunities should be made available to all people, regardless of labor affiliation. ABC is opposed to the provision in this bill that removes the exemption of the installation, remodeling, and repair of last mile infrastructure from the prevailing wage requirement. We are concerned that the prevailing wage will increase the cost of these projects without any guarantee of increase in quality or value, and no guarantee that the work will be performed by local contractors. The claim that anything less than prevailing wage is not a family sustaining wage is false, and it insinuates that contractors who don't pay prevailing wage don't take care of their employees. These insinuations are offensive. Our contractor members pay their employees well and have built up relationships and trust with their employees, which is part of the reason that so many of these folks choose to be merit shop craft professionals. The claim that prevailing wage ensures that only local contractors are awarded work is also untrue. There's nothing in prevailing wage law that requires contractors to be local, and in certain areas of the state, smaller local contractors may be disadvantaged and lose bids to large non-local contractors who can more easily absorb the increased labor costs. Finally, any insinuation that the absence of prevailing wage leads to lower labor standards or lower quality work is without merit. These insinuations are insults to both local contractors who do great work in their communities, as well as thousands of craft professionals who proudly perform high quality work day after day, regardless of whether prevailing wage is paid. Rather than enact policies that increase costs and make it more difficult for high quality contractors to compete, the state should be encouraging policies that promote fair and open competition in the industry and obtain the best value for taxpayers. In conclusion, we respectfully request a no vote on House File 4626. I thank you for the opportunity to provide comment.
Thank you for your testimony. Anybody else that needs to speak on this bill? Seeing no one rushing to the podium. Discussion of the bill. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I had a whole list of really hard-hitting questions for Representative Tabke, but given that we have Representative Greenman, we'll have to take it easy on her today.
Appreciate it.
But just wanted to just get a little bit of clarity, and to Mr. George, it's just really hard on this side of the aisle to hear you say more regulation is good, but we do believe in safety standards. So appreciate those comments, Mr. George, and just wanted to kind of find out, you know, is there any data that's publicly available to us where there are Minnesotans working? Or not just Minnesotans, but there are workers working on the job site today installing broadband for less than $20 an hour.
Mr. George, I think that's correct. Or Emma.
Mr. Chair, and I will turn it over to Mr. George in a second. I think that as we talked about, and as we talked about this bill, I think one of the challenges is it feels like a little bit like the Wild Wild West, and so I don't think that the data is being tracked. I do know, and what I heard from the 49ers who have been working on this bill for a while, is that in other committees, they actually heard a lot of testimony from contractors and others who have seen it on site. And so I think it would be great if we were tracking, actually, wages where people are making, but I think we are, I'm going to turn it over for more, what we're hearing on the ground.
Mr. George, shortly, quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good question. The answer is we don't know a lot. That's why we're here. The prevailing wage is not, certified payroll has not been collected regularly on these projects. 74% are deemed last mile, which exempts prevailing wage laws from being applied. So we don't know what we don't know. We're going a lot with anecdotal stuff that we see on job sites and my agents have seen and our contractors, a dozen or so, that bid against folks see. So we don't have good data, unfortunately.
Representative Schultz.
Mr. Chair, I wanted to maybe ask you if there was another, if there are any other testifiers who could provide evidence of someone making under that dollar an hour. And I kind of raised that because, like, we're facing a workforce crisis in our state, and you know, we've had bills in here to raise the minimum wage, and a lot of those, you know, it's based upon the premise that we want families to be making more money. And my simple question is, like, is this happening today? That's not taking away from the argument for or against the bill. Just we're in this crisis. So are there Minnesotans who are making less than that amount of money doing this highly and critically important work?
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Schultz. I think two things can't be true at the same time. People can't all be making prevailing wage, and then we can't hear from business and industry that if we require prevailing wage, it's going to increase the costs of the project. So I think that what I have taken from industry opposition is that right now prevailing wage is not being followed. Now, if it was, I'm not exactly sure why folks would have a hard time with that. And so I think we should err on the side of ensuring that workers in the field actually make a good family sustaining wage. And I know, as Mr. George and others have talked about, it is a bipartisan supported policy, both federal and at the state, for a reason. It provides that certainty.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I mean, for me, as we see $652 million invested into broadband, I want that to benefit Minnesota customers in addition to Minnesota workers as the installation happens, and a reason why I'm inclined to be more in favor of this bill. I also hear, you know, from I think it's Mr. Twist, who came all the way from Cook County, and I realize, and having traveled northeastern Minnesota, you know, there are extreme distances between these places. So I would just be surprised to hear and open to hearing if there were examples of especially Minnesota workers who are being paid less than that. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further discussion? Representative Meckler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The eyebrows go up.
Yeah. I think this would, what is the current prevailing wage that in this industry right now? Is there like a standard number? Is it regional? I mean, can you give us an idea?
Mr. Chair, for equipment operators, it varies. We have 8 classifications, 8 groups, hundreds of different pieces of equipment, so it varies. $30-$40 an hour, pretty typical, somewhere in there. I mean, we have big range for different pieces of equipment, all the way from a crane, right, to a roller or whatever. So it's hard to give you one answer for us.
And, Mr. George, that also varies where in the state you're working by the prevailing wage in that area.
That's also correct. We have different wage rates for different areas of the state as well, even in our agreement and in prevailing wage.
Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Right now there's a lot of broadband going in my rural area of my little world, but I don't see any cranes out there. I mean, I see a lot of, you know, it's one-ton pickup trucks, big rolls of cable, directional boring machines, small backhoes, very small ones, because they're just digging little holes in the ditches and moving through. So are these people that we're talking about specifically to this industry, are you suggesting that this is in the $30-$40 per hour range?
Mr. George.
Mr. Chair, yeah. Directional drilling, skid steers like you're talking about still make that kind of, and that's just on the check. There's also a $20 an hour wage package, or a benefit package, I'm sorry. So it's $50 plus an hour wage and benefit package on prevailing wage, yes. And that's the industry standard for our industry, for heavy equipment operators, of which we represent 15,000 and the vast majority in this state.
Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I appreciate that. I did have a chance to talk to one of our local companies that does this. And they obviously, if the person handling or operating the equipment is getting paid differently than the one running stuff around or what have you, there's, you know, the more skilled stuff. But I know that they are paying, they're all over in the mid-20s or higher, even for the lowest level job. In fact, my nephew worked there. So I'm not sure what the lowest would be in your world, but there seems to be some consensus there would be an increase, which kind of goes to the concern I think we've heard that there are so many of these rural properties that simply there's no cost effectiveness to these companies to put this stuff in because there's only three houses on a two-mile stretch of road. And so that's where this grant money comes in so crucially important that if this even takes away 20% or 10% of additional miles to get, can get accomplished, because it is going to consume more grant money. We know that. And that's the consideration I think that should be brought up or considered in all of this. I mean, I agree with the safety side of it. Like yourself, I do locates all the time. I'm very familiar with the protocols and the colors and all that, so what they all stand for and mean. And I don't disagree with that aspect of it, but it is a concern when you have these very remote places. In fact, I could not get broadband to my residence for 12 years now, so I ended up going with satellite. Which, once that came up, by the way, it works very efficiently at 390 megabytes per second when we only had seven. So, but either way, that's my 2 cents worth. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I see Representative Charles Subic.
Yes, thank you. And I should have asked this earlier, but I do want to thank the folks both from the industry and the 49ers here and others who are engaged in just working together to find the right solutions that are going to benefit Minnesotans on this. I think that that's positive and just continue to encourage that. There was some testimony. There was a question. There was a statement made about finding a specific classification for broadband prevailing wage. And I just wanted to ask, you know, maybe Mr. George has the answer. Is there an ongoing conversation that will get to this, maybe for a longer-term solution?
Mr. George.
So for heavy equipment operators, the equipment, there's already classifications for us. But that is true for other crafts in broadband. In the previous committee, there was testimony of, you know, what do you pay somebody sitting in a truck splicing wire? I mean, there's different things that happen in broadband that maybe are specific to broadband that I'm unfamiliar with, but the equipment operation piece is universal. There's a prevailing wage classification for a drill, right, or a skid steer. We already have all that stuff. It's the same equipment that's used on in other industries. So not an issue for us. You'll have to ask other crafts about that and whether you would need a specific prevailing wage for that industry or not. Something that could be worked on for sure.
Representative Schultz, any further discussion? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question. We've had several testifiers that testified that the cost would be insurmountable to some of our private, some nonprofit groups and our mom and pop shops. My brother Frank actually works for M&P in Maple Lake, so I'm somewhat familiar, although I've never asked him what he makes an hour. I was told you shouldn't really ask people what they make an hour, but I'm going to when I get home. But and then you had some great testimony, Mr. George, and I thought your testimony was very helpful. But then I think we had Mr. Twice and Mrs. Wolf and Mr. Bush also just say that the cost would be insurmountable or unaffordable for their smaller shops. So my concern is with the $652 million, actually $651 million federal government aid from 2021, there's a lot of money at play. When it comes down, it's all about the money and getting broadband to our rural Minnesotans and making that dollar stretch. We don't know really what the prevailing wage is for, you know, on average. I think you gave us a number of 30 to 40. And I don't know what it is for merit shops or mom and pop shops. Certainly with the shortage of the workforce, it pays pretty well. I think we all agree that you want to have people want to be paid well for their work. And certainly isn't this committee's job to make sure that happens. That's up to the free market, in my personal opinion. But I'd like to hear perhaps from Mr. Twice, I think it was you that said that it's insurmountable costs for the for this prevailing wage provision. Mr. George, you said it's certainly not going to be 30%. That's what the rumor is, and you kind of dispelled that. But another testifier said it's very, very costly. So I think it's important before I decide to vote for it or future, if it does come up, knowing what those costs are, what the projects, how much more percentage of cost are they going to increase should this bill become law?
Mr. George.
Mr. Chair, a good question. So I would say for equipment operators, which is what we do, right, I would say the non-union folks are probably paying a good wage. because we represent the vast majority of them in the state, and I don't know any that are going to work for $15 an hour, right?
Right.
The threat is out-of-state contractors that can find people. It's not local folks. Does that make sense? Like, what I'm worried about is if we don't have any prevailing wage protections on this industry, those local folks in your district, they're paying heavy equipment operators $25, $30, $40 an hour like we do, or close to us anyway. They're going to get swallowed up by the Maztecs of the world that are going to bring people from Texas and pay $18 to $15 an hour or minimum wage, which happens. And our folks are running into some of these people on job sites. So that's the bigger concern to me. It's not the local folks that are non-union. Respect that. That's their choice, those workers' choice. But, you know, because we have such dominant market share, they're forced to pay somewhat close to us, the local folks. My concern is the out-of-state. And when you invest, right now they're not interested in Minnesota because we're investing tens of millions of dollars. You start investing $1 billion in an industry, you're going to get their interest. That's my concern.
Representative McDonald.
Yeah, just to close in, Mr. George, yes, you mentioned that in your testimony, and that certainly is all of our concern. Certainly don't want your union shop to suffer, and all the merit shops, my brother's shop as well, to out-of-state laborers coming in, working, and not perhaps not having the safety standards and paying them less. But as you said earlier, and so did Representative Greenman, that the bill is going to be laid over. There's still some work to do. So I think you guys, Representative Tapke, he'll be in tune, I'm sure, what happens here, will, you know, get together and work and iron out the differences and come up with a conclusion that is best for our state, our merit shops, our union shops, and the money that's coming in here from the federal government. So that's all I have to say about that.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, the bill will be laid over. Thank you, Representative Beeman. And we'll make sure we give Representative Tapke and Nora all the grief we can for not being here. The next bill we have is House File 4659. Yep. And Representative Byrd, Vice Chair Byrd. And we're going to move this. The motion is to move this. We bring this back up to take up the amendments. Oh, that's the okay. That's the next one. Never mind. This is going to be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you. I'm looking at the wrong based on my script. Representative Berg, if you want to make your motion.
Yes, I move that House File 4659 be laid over for possible inclusion in future bill.
Thank you. And you want to explain the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. As you know, the state of Minnesota is making significant investments to fund broadband deployment, and we are about to receive a substantial one-time infusion from the federal government to help assure all Minnesota homes and businesses have access to high-speed broadband in all corners of the state. It is critically important that we get this right. We need to ensure not only that we are investing in high quality, reliable broadband infrastructure, but that the work is done safely and in a manner that develops a skilled workforce that will continue building, maintaining, upgrading, and replacing broadband infrastructures for decades to come. House File 4659 establishes guardrails to ensure that broadband is not being deployed at the expense of worker safety, public safety, or in ways that compromise critical electric, gas, water, and telecommunications infrastructure. This bill raises quality and safety standards, enhances training, reduces turnover, and ensures that our investment in broadband deliver middle-class jobs. It also leverages state and federal investments to support development of skilled workforce and creation of family-supporting careers for Minnesotans. This bill does this by awarding a portion of state and federal broadband development grants to applicants who promote workforce development-based practice and including provisions of skills, training, and family-supporting wages and benefits. Applicants can demonstrate this either by paying the prevailing wage rates currently required for deployment of middle-mile broadband, or by providing employer-funded training, family health coverage, and retirement benefits. I want to be clear. Nothing in this bill prevents an applicant from seeking broadband grant funding, whether they implement workforce best practices or not, as long as the applicant complies with federal law. House File 4659 also establishes a basic safety training standard for the installation of broadband, similar to what exists today for pipe laying in Minnesota, and it also holds bad actors accountable for damage to critical underground utility infrastructure when broadband is installed. House File 4659 is consistent with National Telecommunications and Information Administration labor standard requirements and will strengthen the state's broadband funding application. And I believe I have two testifiers here with me today.
We have a list of testifiers here, more than two. First person on my list is Brad Lato. And after that, I have Abby Hornberger. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning, or good afternoon, I should say. My name is Brad Lato. I'm the Secretary Treasurer of Minnesota AFL-CIO, the collective voice of Minnesota's unions. Thank you, Chair Nelson, and members of the Labor and Industry Finance and Policy Committee for the opportunity to testify. Obviously, I'm here to support House Bill 4659, the broadband bill, and I'd like to thank Representative Burke for authoring this bill. The Minnesota AFL-CIO Executive Board passed a resolution at our January 16th meeting this year. For background, unions on our executive board represent union members of over 77% of the union membership affiliated with the Minnesota AFL-CIO. House File 4659 follows the resolution passed by our board. House File 4659 raises standards for broadband installation, which Representative Burke mentioned, requiring the use of a skilled, well-trained workforce that ensures public safety. Additionally, the bill protects integrity of our existing public and utility infrastructure. As we all know, a reliable high-speed internet service is not a luxury. It is essential to Minnesotans' access to education, health care, and job opportunities, as well as other critical services. With a large amount of federal funding and additional state funding, which was already mentioned, there will be massive investment in high-speed internet connections to families and businesses around the state. We need to do this job right. With the existing buried electric transmission lines and distribution lines for telecommunications, gas, water, and sewer lines, it is vital skilled, trained, and certified workers do the job of broadband installation, which the bill actually requires. The stakes are just too high not to use a well-trained workforce. Minnesota's current broadband grant program also lacks meaningful protections for workers and largely fails to consider job quality investments and workforce development when awarding grants. House File 4659 changes that. The bill ensures that broadband installation is done with a well-trained, certified workforce paid prevailing wage rates with health and retirement benefits. Minnesotans' health and safety and workers' health and safety depend upon this bill being enacted into law this year. The Minnesota AFL-CIO respectfully requests you to support 4659. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Abby Hornberger. And after that, I have Octavio. I'm not even going to try.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. My name is Abby Hornberger. I use she and they pronouns, and I'm the Minnesota policy organizer for the Blue Green Alliance. The Blue Green Alliance supports Representative Berg's bill, HF 4659. Because expanding our broadband connection across the state is essential to ensuring equitable access to the internet, as well as key to our clean energy transition. Expanding broadband and information communication technologies has the potential to create and sustain jobs, revolutionize our energy management, improve energy efficiency, and support economic development. Smarter grids at the transmission level will enable controls to adapt unpredictable weather conditions. Communications technologies will integrate solar panels and electric vehicles into the grid seamlessly, adapting to real-time renewable energy delivery. The unfortunate fact is that often broadband and telecommunications investments have been subcontracted to low-road employers. The tools often used in other construction sectors, like project labor agreements, that set the stage for good-paying and safe jobs on projects haven't been used often enough. We need to do more to lift up the prospects for workers to get good and safe jobs in the broadband sector. That's why we support HF 4659. Getting right matters to us all. The lack of labor standards leads to shoddy work, which impacts consumers and the public. In a nationwide survey of Communication Workers of America technician members at AT&T use of subcontractors, respondents consistently reported problems with the quality of work of subcontractor work. Members most frequently reported that subcontractors cause quality problems leading to higher costs, followed by service quality problems for customers and safety risks for workers and the public. There is potential for broadband and communications technology to make our energy system efficient and effective, but we cannot compromise on worker compensation and benefits for the sake of speedy deployment. I also want to point out that in the bill there are expectations that employers should be providing evidence that they employ and recruit and train people of color, indigenous people, and women in the construction trades, and this is an essential step to make sure that the future of the broadband workforce is inclusive and creates economic opportunities for all. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I'm happy to speak more about this.
Thank you for your testimony. Octavio? If you want to state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Nelson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Octavio Chombustamante. And yeah, you can try, it's not that hard. Octavio Chombustamante. I work as a marketing representative for La Una Labor's International Union of North America. We represent 14,000 proud men and women who build and maintain Minnesota critical infrastructure. I'm here to speak in support of House 504659. But before I start, I want to address the question, if I could, the question from Mr. Schultz. If there is workers making less than $20 per hour, then yes. My coworkers and I, we've been talking to dozens of those workers. With local contractors. They're working for local contractors, non-union contractors. So yes, they are out there. For the past year, my coworkers and I have been interviewing workers installing broadband all over the state. What we have found is very troubling. Anywhere you go in Minnesota, a large majority of workers who build underground electric, gas, water, and sewer lines can earn a good living with middle-class wages, health care, and retirement and benefits. Most underground utilities workers in Minnesota also have access to classroom and hands-on training so they can get the job done right and keep themselves in the communities where they work safe. By talking to workers, I learned that none of these things is true in broadband installation, which is probably why the industry is in a workforce crisis. Sure, some contractors treat workers better than others, but often I met installers who spoke of low pay, minimal benefits, and little to nothing for training. And as we found in the housing construction industry, the worst pay and working conditions are reserved for Latino immigrants workers. I have interviewed dozens of Latino immigrants working in broadband in the Twin Cities and in Greater Minnesota. Most report earning $20 or less in hourly wages. Not a single one reported receiving health care or retirement benefits. Few say they received any training before being put to work on the job. The broadband contractors that rely on this workforce know many of these workers are undocumented and have nowhere else to turn. They know these workers cannot easily leave for another job and that they are afraid that if they speak out, they will quickly be unemployed or not deported, if not reported. It is not fair to build broadband in the back of exploited workers, and it's not safe. It is not safe to rely on untrained, inexperienced workforce because employers are unwilling to invest in training retention. And it is unsafe to rely on a workforce that is too scared to speak up about dangerous installation practices for fear of losing their job or being deported. Please, let's do it right. Support House 504659. And require safety standard for our workers so we can ensure that they are trained to safely and properly install the broadband that so many communities need, being sure to be good stewards of the incredible investment that is being made in our state. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. The next I have David Medina Montana and a translator, uh-huh. Anna Varega. Varega? Vergara, okay. I got to get my eyes checked on.
It's handwritten.
And please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Gracias, representante Nelson y miembros del comité. Mi nombre es David Medina Montaño y vivo en el 10925 Ithaca Lane North, Maple Grove, Minnesota, y vivo con mis dos hijos.
Thank you, Chair Nelson, members of the committee. My name is David Medina Montaño, and I live at 10925 Ithaca Lane North, Maple Grove, Minnesota, 55369, and I live with my two children.
Soy un emigrante de México y residente de este país. Trabajo como obrero de construcción y hasta agosto del 2023 trabajé para un contratista de instalación de fibra óptica, donde era responsable de ubicar líneas subterráneas de gas y electricidad. Trabajé allí como un líder de 4 o 5 trabajadores.
I am an immigrant from Mexico and a resident of this country, and I work as a construction worker. And until August 2023, I worked for a fiber optic installation contractor where I was responsible for locating underground gas and electricity lines. I worked there as a leader to 4 to 5 workers.
La mayoría de mis trabajadores que conozco que instalan fibra óptica reciben maltrato. No nos pagan lo suficiente para mantener a nuestra familia. Y muchos de nosotros no tenemos seguro médico ni ahorros ni para la jubilación.
Most of the workers I know who install fiber optics are treated poorly. We don't get paid enough to support our families, and many of us don't have health insurance or retirement savings.
La mayoría de nosotros nunca recibimos capacitación. Aunque cada día corremos el peligro de chocar con líneas de gas eléctrica. Por ejemplo, sé de un empleado que se lastimó cuando el taladro direccional golpeó una línea eléctrica subterránea y me preocupé.
Most of us never receive training, even though we are in danger of hitting gas and power lines every day. For example, I know of an employee who was injured when the directional drill hit an underground power line, and I was concerned.
Aunque las condiciones son malas para muchos trabajadores en la industria, nosotros los migrantes de América Latina recibimos el peor trato. Cuando trabajaba para ese contratista ganaba solo $17 la hora, sin beneficio de salud ni jubilación, a pesar de que era uno de los trabajadores con más experiencia.
Although conditions are bad for many workers in the industry, we immigrants from Latin America receive the worst treatment. When I worked for a fiber optic contractor, I made only $17 an hour with no health insurance or retirement benefits, even though I was one of the most experienced workers.
Nosotros jefes prometían darnos aumentos a los 3 meses, pero pasó el tiempo y nunca sucedió. En agosto, mis compañeros de trabajo y yo decidimos que no aguantábamos más con el mal maltrato. Y nos reunimos con un representante sindical. Él nos explicó que teníamos derecho como trabajadores a hablar sobre los bajos salarios y las condiciones inseguras en el lugar del trabajo.
Our boss always promised to give us raises after 3 months, but time passed and it never happened. In August, my coworkers and I decided we couldn't take the abuse anymore and met with a union representative. He explained to us that we had the right as workers to speak about low wages and unsafe conditions in the workplace.
Mis compañeros de trabajo y yo estábamos muy emocionados porque estábamos cansados de que nos trataran mal y de escuchar a los jefes hacer promesas que no cumplían. Hablamos con otros compañeros de cómo se organizaron y varios de nosotros nos reunimos otra vez con el personal del sindicato después del trabajo. Para averiguar cómo podríamos organizar nuestro propio sindicato.
My coworkers and I were very excited because we were tired of being treated poorly and hearing bosses make promises they didn't keep. We talked to other coworkers about how to organize ourselves, and several of us met again with the staff of a union called IUNA after work to meet to find out how we could organize our own union.
Al día siguiente, los tres líderes nos despidieron de nuestro trabajo a pesar de que éramos buenos trabajadores. Sabíamos que lo que hacía la empresa estaba mal. Por eso el sindicato nos ayudó a presentar una denuncia ante la Junta Nacional de Relaciones Laborales por violar nuestros derechos.
The next day, all three leaders were fired from our jobs, even though we were good workers. We knew the company was what the company was doing was wrong, so the union helped us file a complaint with the National Labor Relations Board for violating our rights.
Seis meses después, la Junta terminó su investigación y determinó que sí nos violaron nuestros derechos cuando nos despidieron y cuando presentaron a la policía una queja contra uno de mis compañeros. Fue una experiencia terrible ser despedido.
6 months after, the NLRB finished their investigation, determined that they had violated our rights when they fired us and when they presented a complaint against us with the police. It was a terrible experience being fired.
Sé que asustó a mis compañeros de trabajo, aunque la ley dice que los trabajadores tienen derechos. Ellos vieron lo que puede suceder cuando intentan hacer algo en nuestros derechos. Entiendo que la gente de Minnesota quiere un mejor internet para todos, pero les pido que no lo hagan a costa de los trabajadores que están siendo abusados, especialmente los inmigrantes que no tienen manera de protegerse de abusos. Gracias por escucharme.
I know it scared my ex-coworkers. Although the law says the workers have rights, they say they saw what can happen when we try to use our rights. I understand that the people of Minnesota want better internet for all, but I ask you do not do it at the expense of the workers who are being abused, especially immigrants who have no way to protect against abuse. Thank you for hearing me.
Thank you for your testimony. The next person I have on my list is Tom Hansen, followed by John Twist. Welcome back. Again, state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Tom Hansen, and I am here testifying on behalf of my client, again, the Minnesota Telecom Alliance. And like I said a few minutes ago, they are a mix of co-ops, family-owned, privately held, and publicly traded broadband providers throughout Minnesota. I didn't mention before, and I should have, that they, MTA members, are planning to invest nearly $300 million in private capital to expand broadband in Minnesota. Like on the last bill, MTA has significant issues with the bill, but commit to working with the authors and other stakeholders to try to come up with some way to come up with language that's agreeable to all. We want to incentivize participation in state and federal programs, but try not to put up roadblocks that will de-incentivize the providers who have successfully deployed broadband throughout Minnesota. And what do I mean by roadblocks? We're worried that this bill puts at risk the loss of $652 million in federal BEAD money earmarked for Minnesota because it does not comply with the BEAD program rules and obligations. MTA recently polled all of its rural broadband provider members, and not one of them said they would likely apply for BEAD dollars under the current language in House File 4659. The reporting obligations and regulatory burden are too onerous and not worth their matching private investment. And these are companies that have participated in the broadband, border-to-border broadband grant program since its inception. But I do want to say, and I want to end with MTA's commitment to work with the authors and the stakeholders. We've had some conversations with the stakeholders and try to find some language that is acceptable for all parties. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen. John Twist, and then Melissa Wolf.
Thank you.
And welcome back.
Thank you.
State your name.
Sure. My name is John Twist, and as I mentioned, I'm from Cook County. It's good to see you again, testifying again. And I'll dispense with some of the repetitive things as we went through. But we do understand the challenge of bringing broadband to the unserved and underserved areas of the state. When we applied for our grant in 2009, we were the worst connected county in the state of Minnesota. And that is obviously no longer the case. We have the ability to bring gigabit digital service to all of our members. The proposed mandate on workforce practices will lead to fewer project applicants and fewer Minnesotans getting access to broadband service. This will negatively impact the grants that were designed to help those in the economically vulnerable areas of Minnesota and make broadband service difficult to afford. This is completely contrary to the purpose of closing the digital divide.
As I mentioned before, our experience in the extremely high cost areas of Minnesota give us very unique insights into the economics of building and maintaining this broadband infrastructure. With the goal of bringing broadband to all Minnesotans without grant funding, this simply will not happen. Adding additional mandates to an already complicated, highly compliance-oriented, and very restrictive grant opportunity will only deter cooperatives and service providers from applying for these grants. The Department of Employment and Economic Development, Office of Broadband Development, and the Governor's Appointed Task Force on Broadband have recently celebrated a decade of working with key stakeholders, local community leaders, to ensure the governor's vision of broadband access for all Minnesotans is achieved. The proposed language in this bill will destabilize the nonpartisan, stakeholder-driven approach of the Office of Broadband Development and reduce the effectiveness of the governor's task force, potentially impacting the disbursement of funds from the Broadband Equity Access and Deployment Program, administered by National Telecommunications and Information Administration. The Office of Broadband Development has effectively managed and distributed hundreds of millions of dollars over the past 10 years. We should continue to rely on their proven track record as we inch ever closer toward the goal of broadband for all Minnesotans. While this legislation is geared toward promoting workforce development and equitable access for all, the rigid requirements and impact on financial viability of projects will ultimately slow the progress of broadband deployments. Respectfully, again, I urge you to consider the damaging impact of this legislation that will have on the governor's vision of bringing broadband to all Minnesotans. Let's continue the success of the Department of Employment and Economic Development, Office of Broadband Development, to administer and manage the initiatives that they have created to advance broadband access and connectivity across our great state. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you for your testimony. Melissa Wolf, and then I have again John Beshe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, my name is Melissa Wolf, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Cable Communications Association. As I testified earlier on House File 4626, Minnesota is in the home stretch in the race to achieve universal broadband goals with the help of $652 million in federal grant funding from the BEAD program. Unfortunately, with the finish line in sight and other states behind us, House File 4659 would also stop Minnesota's pursuit of universal broadband service in its tracks. In designing the BEAD program, the National Telecommunications and Information Administration, or NTIA, mandated that the Office of Broadband Development award grants in a manner that ensures the deployment of service to all underserved locations. NTIA provided OBD 4 years to deploy $652 million to meet that mandate. OBD has already submitted their BEAD plan, and it's currently under review by NTIA. Amending this now will absolutely impact the deployment of those funds. In addition, and as was discussed during the last bill, the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry establishes prevailing wage rates through a long list of job classifications. Many of these classifications are incongruous with the actual jobs performed in the telecommunications and broadband industry. Due to this incongruity, it is difficult to estimate how a requirement to pay prevailing wage would impact Minnesota's purchasing power through border-to-border and BEAD, though it would absolutely be significant. Further, the process that would be required to add job classifications or determine prevailing wages for jobs that do not fit existing classifications would be time-consuming and certainly delay the disbursement and deployment of BEAD funds. Lastly, in advocating for new certification requirements for underground telecommunications installers under this bill, proponents have been advancing a narrative that broadband construction workers are untrained and that the industry's safety record is poor. Having been doing this work in the state for decades and in partnership with the Office of Broadband Development, this recently contrived narrative is largely anecdotal. Further, our construction activity is already adequately regulated by the Minnesota Office of Pipeline Safety, which this bill actually seems to move jurisdiction from, and federal and state OSHA regulations. This year, the Office of Broadband Development celebrated its 10th anniversary. Over those 10 years, MCCA members have worked in strong partnership with the office to create what's known nationally as the Minnesota model. Through that model, we've brought our state to the threshold of universal broadband. BEAD funding provides a once-in-a-generation opportunity to cross that threshold. If this bill becomes law, the state will fail to meet its federal mandate and its 2026 speed goals. We are committed to working with proponents of the bill and finding compromise where we can. House File 4659 would create new and additional roadblocks and barriers that will result in many Minnesotans and many Minnesota communities continuing to wait for a broadband rollout that never materializes. Thank you, and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Beshe. Welcome back. State your name for the record.
Thank you again. John Beshe, Associated Builders and Contractors in Minnesota. Our concerns with this bill center around two particular points, specifically with the allocation of certain percentages of border-to-border broadband grants to applicants who commit to implementing certain workforce practices. First, we're concerned with the subjectiveness of the requirement that there be credible evidence of support from one or more labor management, or other workforce organizations to receive priority consideration for the grants. We are concerned that this requirement will be used to favor certain segments of the industry over others. For example, ABC is a trade association composed of high-quality local contractors. Will credible evidence of support from a trade association like ABC be considered sufficient when considering whether an applicant meets these requirements? Or in practice, will anything short of union support be considered insufficient to meet this requirement? We don't want this to result in a barrier. Second, it's unclear as to why a contractor can opt to pay either prevailing wage or provide the 80 hours of skills training annually and the employer-paid family health insurance coverage and employer-paid retirement benefits. If this bill is about safety and quality of training, it's perplexing that a contractor could opt out of the annual skills training requirement simply by paying prevailing wage. The payment of prevailing wage is not synonymous with quality or safety, nor does it guarantee that an employee receives those benefits. It appears as though this provision is providing a carve-out for a certain segment of the construction industry while imposing additional mandates on the remainder of the industry, which is the antithesis of fair and open competition. In conclusion, we are opposed to House File 4659. I thank you for the opportunity to provide comment.
Thank you for your testimony. Discussion on the bill. I think I had Representative Mecklen. Did you?
I did. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Unfortunately, well, not maybe fortunately, Mr. Beshe just kind of asked part of or made reference to one of my concerns I've had since we had this bill on energy. Lines 3.4. Why would you have the word or if this is about, as you stated in Energy Committee, about fair wages, safer, better trained laborers, but you have the word or? So you can simply pay more money and avoid all the additional training, or you could do the training and not spend the money. Is that how I'm to perceive this section?
Representative Byrd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative. I will let one of my testifiers answer that question.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record, and then proceed.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Thanks for the question. Adam Hutchins, Laguna, Minnesota, researcher, marketing rep. So there's two components of the training. It would the bill has a training component for everybody. It's a common sense training requirement for anybody doing the installation in the entire industry across the entire state of Minnesota, either subsidized or not. The bill would look to incentivize those companies that want to do above and beyond the basic. So it's not a get out of training or pay prevailing wage. It's, hey, do you want to do more training than what's required by law, as in the other part of the bill? Or are you willing to do prevailing wage and you'd still meet the intent of the training requirement in the other part of the bill?
Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm still, if there's already sufficient training, then and this would be additional. I mean, I do this kind of work, not necessarily fiber, but I do locates all the time. And as has been mentioned, you're running near gas lines, power lines, all kinds of things. And when you've ever watched somebody else, because I've never done it, make a bad mistake, they get very costly very quick or can be incredibly dangerous. I guess you could probably never train enough to identify. I wonder if there's anybody here who actually does put in fiber in the ground from Liuna. Is there any laborers that are here by chance? No?
Can I answer that?
Go ahead, sir.
Thanks for the question. The previous testifier is a Liuna member now that is installing fiber optics.
Okay.
If that's what you're looking for.
Well, if... I guess I'm still stumped as to why it wouldn't be end. If this is going to make the person safer and better trained, because this can be a if you've ever seen like a bobcat or a backhoe hit a high voltage power line or a gas line in particularly, I mean, you can literally wipe out an entire house in the blink of an eye. So I just find this, and I guess the other side is this seems like in direct competition with the bill we just heard. Is it? It seems that there's a lot of different parts to these two. So are they accomplishing the same goal, or are there conflicting goals between these two?
Representative Byrd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question. They're not in conflict, and likely we're going to work together, Representative Tabke and I, to see how we can put the two together and come out with the best possible bill. I think what we're trying to do here is just make sure that the investment that's going to be made and the jobs that it's going to create, that they're going to be jobs with that will attract skilled workers, and therefore being the safest and being able to, as I made in my opening remarks, these jobs are going to be middle class jobs.
Representative Becklin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Perhaps somebody can answer me this, that for like the Liuna side of the union, opposed to the previous bill was for, I believe, the 49ers, how many people currently in this union, as much as I understand this, are currently in the burying of broadband or industry right now compared to how many are current active employees and laborers in the 49ers?
I didn't catch your name in the beginning.
Thanks, journalist Adam Hutchins. So is the question comparison between the 49ers' current workforce and Liuna's current workforce in the existing broadband infrastructure space?
Correct.
Okay. So the answer would be hard to tell you because there are contractors doing gas distribution, electric distribution, and broadband distribution. So it's not like that person is cataloged as just a broadband installer for Liuna, because the classifications are so similar. The work is so similar, contractors doing all of them. And I don't know the 49ers numbers, to be honest. So to compare the two, I don't think I'd be. I don't know if there is an answer, to be honest.
And Mr. Chair, there are also CWA workers that work on various pieces of the overall process as well.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think just I initial question here, based upon this, I just want to ask Representative Berg, how does this impact the last mile of broadband infrastructure?
Representative Berg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question, Representative Schultz. I will defer to Adam for that.
Mr. Hutchins.
So how would it change the last mile? It essentially doesn't change the last mile. It just says if you're a grant recipient and you can make prevailing wage work, or you can make workforce best practices on your entire grant, you can choose to use those, so which would include last mile infrastructure. It doesn't carve out or change the last mile definition or anything, if that's what you're looking for. It also, to remind everybody, it's not a mandate that all the money flows through either prevailing wage or workforce best practices. It gives space for those we've heard before. This is meant to right size it. So if a single internet service provider area cannot create an application that would fit under prevailing wage or would not fit under the workforce best practices, there's still 50% of the money in the first year, 40%, 30% over that, that would be unaffected completely by this bill in any way, shape, or form in the funding structure or the scoring mechanism. So it will not change the last mile definition and or carve out. It essentially just says if you can do the work, it incentivizes them. If they can do the work at that level, then they should come to the front of the line.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I'm hearing you say is it does not remove the current exemption for the last mile.
Mr. Hutchinson.
Yep. Much shorter answer than that. No, it does not.
All right. Thank you for that. Interesting. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just kind of considering that just based upon the cost that it takes for the last mile here. So, and then an additional question here, Representative Berg, we have new language in here that directs the Department of Labor and Industry to establish some new guidelines and new practices to work on helping create these courses and whatnot. Can you tell us, is there a fiscal note for this bill?
Representative Byrd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Schultz. We do not have a fiscal note at the moment.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you. Do we have...
Laid over.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there someone from the Department of Labor and Industry who could help us understand the labor sections to this bill?
Again, state your name for the record and then answer the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Sean O'Neill, I serve as Assistant Director for the Construction Codes and Licensing Division with DLI.
And did you hear the question?
Could you please repeat? Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Representative Schultz.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you kind of outline for us what kind of additional burden this would place upon the Department of Labor and Industry to stand up the standards that are found inside this bill?
Mr. O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. As we looked at the fiscal note and looking at the background of what this bill would mandate the department to take care of, we estimated that it would take roughly a quarter of a full-time equivalent to develop the training program that's outlined in the bill, and then vet with outside department approved providers who would provide the training course. And it's similar to some of our OSHA programs where it's more of the department vetting outside providers that are setting up and monitoring those training programs. But on from the onset, the department would have to develop the training structure in the program. And so we saw that as a relatively minor lift from the department. Estimating a quarter FTE would be allotted to developing that program.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Based upon that information and what's in the bill, could you share with us what the position of the Department of Labor is to this bill?
Mr. O'Neill.
The position, our stance on this particular bill is neutral, Representative.
Thank you.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a few questions for Mr. Hansen, actually.
Mr. Hansen, welcome back.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to figure out how these grants work. So for all of these grants that are all these federal grants, do all of these grants have these workforce requirements attached to them? Because it's my understanding that not all of them do. In fact, it's about like it's a 50-50 maybe where they do have, where these grants, some of them have no workforce requirements and some do. So can you explain to me, do they all have workforce requirements? Do not all of them? How does that work?
Mr. Hansen.
Mr. Chair and members, I don't know if somebody from the Office of Broadband is here. I don't do that on a day-to-day basis, so I wouldn't be able to answer your question.
Is there somebody here from the Office of Broadband? Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record, and did you hear the question?
Good afternoon. My name is Bree Mackey, and I'm the Executive Director at the Office of Broadband Development. Just for clarity, can the question be restated?
Can you state?
Yeah, sorry. Thank you for being here. Thank you for helping me with this. So it's my understanding that for when people apply for these, that there are grants that have workforce requirements and some that don't. So is that true? How would that work with the grants management and the workforce stipulations.
Ms. Mackey.
Thank you, Chair and Representative. So it's a little bit more complicated, I think, than the question you're asking. So specifically to federal grants, there are certain requirements, and then with state grants, there are different requirements. So I don't know if you want me to clarify that, but the only federal dollars that we are talking about that our Office of Broadband would be administering is through the BEAD dollars. All the other federal dollars in broadband are administered by like the USDA, other federal agencies.
Representative Jordan.
Mr. Chair, I would like a little bit more clarity on that, if you could kind of succinctly, like, what has workforce requirements, what doesn't, and then what would this bill change? Would this bill affect all federal grants, or would it affect some but not others? Maybe you could just talk about how it would this bill, should it become law, would relate to the process for these grants.
And Representative Jordan, this bill's getting laid over, so if you don't have that information with you now, and you can't study it off the top of your head, you could get that to the committee. That would be great. Ms. Mackey.
Yes, thank you, Chair and Representative. So specific to the BEAD program, we are in the process of working with the National Telecommunication Information Administration, so NTIA, to form a plan that works for Minnesota. So this particular bill does have some possible impacts of how we will be able to get that money through NTIA and the federal dollars and be able to implement that. But we are really committed in working with our partners here to get a plan together that works for all of us, as well as ensuring the people that are doing the work are paid fairly. But as far as the actual requirements, every state is doing this a little bit differently.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would like a little bit more clarity on that, but it sounds like not all of the grants would be affected by these workforce requirements. And so I find some of the statements about pulling out of all programs to be concerning when this bill wouldn't affect all of the grant processes, is what I'm understanding. So I guess I think when we hear about people saying that prevailing, that when people talk about anecdotes about workers having more protections and painting things with a broad brush, it seems like there's a lot of that going on, and I'm glad that Representative Berg, that you're working on this and making sure that everyone is taken care of, because the internet is, as much as it I think sometimes is a nuisance, it is a necessity. And the other thing I'd keep in mind is these workers are Minnesota workers, and they are as much a part of this as everyone else is, as the internet providers and the contractors. And so making sure these workers have the protections they need. I mean, we'd already heard a little bit about workforce shortages, but this bill really goes to addressing those workforce shortages, where it talks about bringing in people who have been underserved in the construction industry. And so I think it's good that we're putting this in here to really address some of those workforce shortages. And I would appreciate some more clarity on what grants would be especially affected by this bill. Thank you.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will be brief and won't ask my questions because I know we're running out of time, but I just wanted to say, someone who's got to spend a lot of time on this weekend, what we have heard from both, I think, the 49ers and LIUNA, and frankly, speaking on behalf of, and many of, both of them testified to talking to lots of non-union workers too, is that there is a big problem. And what we didn't hear from the industries is how they're going to solve it. Whether it's paying for, making sure that we're paying a prevailing wage, and also the safety issues. And so I know that there's a few different ways to skin a cat, and we have a couple of different bills, but I am appreciative that folks are working together. What I heard Ms. Wolf say is that that there's a Minnesota model, and that Minnesota model shouldn't be to spend hundreds of millions of government dollars for cheap out-of-state labor that undermines the safety in our communities. That Minnesota model should be understanding that when we're going to invest public dollars in privately owned infrastructure, what we should assume is that those the workers get paid a family-sustaining wage, and that we are and that we are ensuring that in our communities, when this is being installed, that we have the safety training. So thank you, Representative Berg. Thank you a little less to Representative Tapke. And I appreciate that the work that is being done on this, because know that there's lots of workers out there who may not be represented by a union, but have a big stake in this.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, if I can make a suggestion at your discretion that we, since these two bills are being labeled, tabled or laid over, and the next bill I believe is going to the general register, that perhaps we can at least have 4 minutes to discuss the next bill, which was already ran out of time the last time?
We have a little bit extra time. We've checked with the House TV and then we've got a little extra time. So, yes, we can. I mean, if you want to just lay these over right now because that's what they're going to be done, we could do that and then we can move to the next bill.
I think that would be a prudent idea, Mr. Chair, yes.
So Representative Berg renews her motion that House File 4659 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Mr. Chair, just some closing remarks on this one very quickly. To a couple of the points that we talked about, there was some confusion about prevailing wage versus more training. But if you continue reading the lines of the bill, it talks about certainly more training, but also family health coverage and retire benefits. So what we're getting at with both of those, where the or comes in, it's prevailing wage or it's the training, but also the benefits and retirement. So we're getting at the heart of compensating workers. The last thing that I want to say is that I find it very interesting when we have discussions like this, that when industry comes in, everything that they say are facts. And when workers speak, it's anecdotes. And I want to be very clear that the workers are the ones on the ground doing the work, experiencing the things that we're talking about. And so those are the facts. As much as any industry data, the workers' experience equals just as many facts as industries. And I want us to keep that in mind as we continue to move forward with this bill. I am interested in working with any stakeholders or any of the friends on that side of the table if you have suggestions. But what I am not open to doing is continuing to build this country on the backs of immigrants and workers that are not being fairly compensated or being kept safe. Thank you.
And with that, this bill is laid over. The next bill we have is House File 4818. And I'm losing my voice here. And Representative Berg, this is going to the general register if you want to make your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 4818 be sent to the general register.
And members, we've had a lot of discussion on this. We had testimony. We're here to do the amendments and discuss the bill then. So now that the bill's in front of us, I have a handful of amendments here, and I'll start with the A3. And who has the A3 amendment?
That would be me, Mr. Chair.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just mention, just kind of to your last point, you know, last time we were here discussing this bill, it was only testimony that we took. There wasn't any member discussion so far. And I know that there's plenty of concerns and questions. And I know, frankly, a lot of the folks in attendance here have concerns with this bill and certainly can continue to offer their voice. I move the A3 amendment, and this just says that instead of just kind of picking one spot in the state of Minnesota where standards like this would apply, that they would then apply statewide. It would include the state of Minnesota and vendors of the state of Minnesota, and whenever a state vendor requests or goes through the RFP process.
And Representative Berg, what is your pleasure with the A3 amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Schultz, for your amendment. I'm going to recommend that we have a no vote on the amendment.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I wanted to ask the chair, or not the chair, but the author of the bill, why this should apply differently to the MAC versus the rest of the state of Minnesota.
Representative Berg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Schultz. So what we're finding out about the airport workers, and I've said before, they are the ones that make my job possible. They are often low-wage or immigrant workers, and this is just one more way that our workers are being taken advantage of. And so right now, this bill focuses on those particular workers at that particular location, and nobody is happier than I would be to address it for all workers in every situation across the state. So if you want to work on that with me, that would be awesome.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to just kind of point out the irony that it's only this one particular location, despite the challenges that we've heard even today about immigrant workers across the entire state facing challenges like this. If this is truly about the immigrant workers, it's also targeting small employers. So I'm just I brought forward this amendment to kind of gain an understanding as to why we wouldn't hold the state of Minnesota to the exact same standard that is put forward in this underlying bill.
And with that, members, all in favor of the A3 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
The motion does not pass, does not prevail. The A3 is not adopted. I have the A4 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That would be me again.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A4 amendment says that while we were unable to take on the entire state government and hold them to the same standards of this bill, this says, well, there's a lot of these same workers who work at colleges and universities in Minnesota, and we should include them. So that is the A4 amendment.
And Representative Berg, what is your pleasure with the amendment to your bill?
Thank you, Representative, or thank you, Chair and Representative Schultz. I'm once again going to recommend a no vote on this. And I love what you said about, you know, the last bill it addressed immigrant workers, this bill addressed immigrant workers. Right. So I'm excited that we can just make sure that we're introducing legislation that covers all of our workers in the various different industries with the things that are particular to that industry, the challenges and the barriers that they're experiencing. So I'm going to recommend a no vote on this.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm kind of concerned on the general path that we're on here. My priority sitting around this table is to prioritize and to help Minnesota workers, Minnesotans themselves, and certainly if a bill is going to come forward like this and target one particular area, that it should have a more full-throated support across the state. And so at this time, Mr. Chair, realizing the lateness of the hour in this committee, I'm going to withdraw the A4 amendment.
Representative Schultz withdraws the A4 amendment. I have an A5 amendment.
Mr. Chair, I'm withdrawing that A5 amendment.
Representative McDonald withdraws the A5 amendment. I have an A6 amendment.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I have an A6 amendment. Representative Berg, this would apply to other airports within the state, and it doesn't just target one area, one major hub, one airport that has received, six or seven top airports in the nation, including six in a row, which include all kinds of things such as cleanliness and customer service and cost of goods and employee satisfaction. So we have a really good thing going at our Minneapolis airport. I am blessed by the good Lord to fly quite often photographically when I'm not here at the Capitol. So I do get there often and enjoy the airport quite a bit. But I think it should be fair that if it's one airport, it should be there'd be no reason why not to do other airports. I don't see any logic in it. So I'm just would like to offer this. Yep. Representative Berg includes the St. Paul Regional Airport and Duluth International Airport and the St. Paul Downtown Airport, Holman Field. And I said St. Cloud, didn't I? And just includes all the airports, so we're not just targeting MSP.
So you, Representative McDonald, you're moving the A6 amendment?
I am moving the A6 amendment.
Thank you, Representative. And Representative McDonald, I'm a little just taken back. You're not going after Crystal Airport, which is in part of my district. But anyway,
Mr. Chair, I know that I flew out of there just a couple of months ago with the CAP, so I will leave them alone.
Yeah. Representative Burr, what's your pleasure with the amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative McDonald. I can't believe we haven't crossed paths. I am just awaiting the day you end up on one of my flights. That's going to be really fun, Mr. Chair. To maybe say a couple of words about this amendment, I would call upon Ms. Diaz. We can maybe get a little information on that.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
My
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, Representative. My name is Samantha Diaz. I'm the political director of SEIU Local 26. We represent about 1,300 passenger service workers at the airport, and about roughly 200 of those workers are janitors. We've been working closely with our partners at Unite Here, who have around 1,200 workers at the airport, at MSP specifically, and the Teamsters Local 120 with a couple hundred members. For us, there is an acuteness at MSP specifically, and so that's why this particular the legislation is geared for MSP.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, I, in lieu of my amendment, which I think is a bad amendment, actually, same here with the bill. I don't think that the bill is would be good for MSP or for all employers and even the employees. So I withdraw this amendment.
And Mr. Chair, if I just may address that. Thank you so much. The reason that we focused on MSP only is because those workers do typically make a higher wage than at some of the regional airports that you put forth in this amendment. And let's not confuse the fact that just because they make a little higher wage that they're okay. What that means is oftentimes they lose that medical assistance because they just come in on the cusp, so they neither can afford medical care and then they lose any assistance that they might have. So they're just basically left with no option, and that's why this bill is about getting an employer contribution for them to be able to buy into the employer-based health plan. If they choose not to do that, they do not get the dollar amount we've outlined. So I hope that just clarifies if you have any further amendments you're considering.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Berg. It doesn't clarify anything because the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, that came out many years ago, was supposed to be the answer to all of this affordable care, health care. And it seems to be failing because of you need another bill that will tack on another $4.88 per hour per employee on everybody at the MSP, including the gas station that's just adjacent to that. So it's not clear at all that because with the Affordable Care Act and health care was supposed to be affordable, that this bill is even needed. I'm not clear on that. And I have to say that the cost of things at the airport is already significant for those who fly, and Representative Berg, you do, the cost of a donut to a cup of coffee to a piece of candy bar, very expensive. A gin and tonic is almost $10. Double is $12.50. Or maybe 14. Not that I know. I just remember. An Irish beer is too expensive. It's $2.50 in Delano on happy hour. So the cost is significant. And that, if you remember, one of the Delta or Mac testifiers testified that if they could lose in a hub, a major hub, because of the cost is a consideration. And surely because you work there and that is your profession and your love and vocation, you don't want to harm that either. Mm-hmm. And many those employees have really good health care already. For those who don't, we have a federal program, the ACA, that takes care of those who are in your level that you had mentioned. Mm-hmm. That is why that Affordable Care Act was initiated in the first place. Mm-hmm. So your bill will increase the costs significantly and could damage the hub that we have at Minneapolis Airport and the beauty that it is, from what I hear from testifiers and my own personal opinion and others here as well.
Representative Hussein, you had a question.
May I respond, Chair? I will. Thank you for that. I think that we've grown comfortable with the narrative that everything is expensive because we're paying workers, and that's just patently false. There is nothing in this bill that is going to threaten MSP being a Delta hub or having any other airlines that come and participate. It makes way too much money. It is a fabulous location for where Delta, American, United, where they all want to go. None of that is in danger because we want to allow people that are going to push your loved one in a wheelchair from one plane to another if they have health care, none of that is under threat. So that is a narrative that is far too easy and far too simple, and I hope we're better thinkers than that.
Representative Hussein.
Thank you for bringing this bill forward. And Samantha Diaz, I have a question for you. What's the percentage of immigrants that are working at the airport? Do you know?
Ms. Diaz.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is a good question. I know for our local, just in general, we represent 8,000 janitors, security officers, airport service workers at the at MSP. So largely black, brown immigrant workers, largely Latino and East African of our 8,000 membership.
Representative Hussein.
Thank you. And the reason I ask is the majority of people that does the cleaning and do the labor work are people of color and immigrant, correct?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Representative, yes, largely overwhelming majority immigrant.
Thank you. And the reason I'm asking is that the backbone of in our country has a rich history, because the backbone in immigrant that has been built and uplift for many aspects. And I am proud to support this bill, and thanks for bringing forward Good Airport Act. It's good workers that deserve living wage, affordable health care, and a voice at the job in the union. Our people deserve to feel safe and respected in their workplace. The many reasons that we are seeing and have a number one clean airport and atop the nation is because those people that have been working so hard to do cleanings, or if someone that need to get to wheelchair, like my dad utilized, and he's 86 years old, and every time he's trying to travel, he travel alone because he has accessibility for those people that speak multiple language, for those people that get to his gate and where he need to be at. So I am fighting, and I want to make sure that these people get what they deserve and make sure they're treated with respect. Thank you very much.
Representative Myers.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Berg. Just a few questions. So we know that businesses at the MAC are restricted on what they can charge. And I'm just wondering if from, you know, your research, have any studies been done that show that these businesses are going to be able to absorb this cost, given a lot of them are still digging out from the pandemic?
Representative Berg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Schultz. I'll defer to Ms. Diaz.
Ms. Diaz.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. Just the airline industry is a heavily subsidized industry, just period. They've received billions of dollars in COVID relief money. And just recently, there was a $150 million investment to bring Sun Country to MSP. So there's no shortage of money available, and what these corporations are making on their bottom line. So just to paint the context of the issue around healthcare, only 30% of employees at MSP accept employer-provided health insurance. What that looks like for our members, 80% of the folks that have insurance get it from like Minshore or government subsidized programs. So we are talking about billions investment from an airline industry, and then it's a twofer in that our employees are still forced to either not accept insurance or go through government subsidized health care.
Representative Myers.
Thank you. Could you, for the testifier, repeat again, you know, because it leads to a different question I have. And the answer provided, I think, was for some of the larger corporations. I mean, I've got a couple, you know, female business owners that run operations in the MAC and are deeply concerned about being able to, you know, the position they've been put in and what they've done to cover previous, you know, employees or businesses that have shut down and taken those employees on, that now, you know, this is going to put another burden on them. And the question that I had was, what percentage of people, and I think maybe you said it, but just sort of clarify, are not taking the insurance, and if you guys have studied this, and where they're getting their insurance from, if it's a family member or a mentor, I'd love to know what those percentages are.
Ms. Diaz, shortly, quickly.
Yep, Mr. Chair, Representative, so the MAX survey that we've received through a FOIA request, they, in the survey of their employers at the airport, 30% of employees accept employer-provided health insurance. Our own data of our membership, of our between Unite Here and Local 26, it was reported, the survey revealed that 80% of those of our workers at the airport have insurance through government subsidized health care.
Representative Myers.
And thank you for that. And so hopefully, you know, you can work with, you know, we heard some testimony before that they've, you know, Delta, other agencies have done a lot of research in finding out, you know, what benefits are most important to people and taking your information, that information, and trying to, you know, figure something out. You know, the MAC has kind of been at the forefront of some of these labor standards. You know, first time doing, implementing $15 an hour, you know, paid sick leave, worker retention, and it was brought up here before. I'm kind of confused why we're targeting them when they've kind of been at the forefront of trying to address some of these things. The final question I would have is, you know, from the implementation of this, is there any concern that these owners and operators in these businesses will now pick and choose to reduce other benefits to cover this? Have there been any studies or surveys that you guys have completed?
Ms. Diaz.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so to the last portion of your question, for our employers, for Local 26 employers, they pay about $3.02 per hour towards health insurance. That's assuming 40 hours. What we are talking about in this bill, the intent, is to close that gap from the SEA peg of 498, and so cover that difference in the effort to ensure that our members have the ability to accept health insurance.
Representative Myers.
Yep, and my final point is just, I think we really have to think long and hard when we look at the operations of these bills, and when you start dictating benefits on employees, on employers. What I've heard too many times from, you know, employees that I talk to in my district are now they're afraid that you're gonna, you know, they're gonna get a piece of paper that says here's the benefits that the state says that we have to give you, and you're gonna lose other benefits that may be more important to those employees. So, you know, I'm just hopeful that we can, you know, make sure that we're balancing that out.
Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Berg, or perhaps your testifier, is there, why wouldn't the union just negotiate this that represents all these employees? I've kind of heard conflicting things, so I'm not sure if that I'm understanding.
Representative Berg.
Thank you. I will let Ms. Diaz answer that.
Ms. Diaz.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. We are currently in, Local 26 specifically, is currently in bargaining with our passenger service, our passenger and service employer. In terms of why the MAC, it is incumbent on the MAC to protect its proprietary interest in ensuring a good, strong workforce with low turnover. And this is an opportunity for them to do that, given that this has been an issue that we've been talking to them with over for nearly 3 years with no solution.
Representative Mecklen, I've got two more people on the list that aren't.
All right, go ahead. I'll let it ride. I do have to get to another committee too.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you. I just actually wanted to kind of point out that I think that there's maybe an air of bipartisanship that we can get to here. We're dealing with workforce challenges and the crisis there. And this before us and a lot of the bills that we've seen here have just been, frankly, a government forward solution, more government intervention to the challenges that we face. And I really feel like it might be incumbent upon us to just reduce a few of those barriers, allow the private sector to grow a little bit, and then focus upon our tax policy. Because our challenge here, the reason that we're having these issues with medical assistance is we have a broken system that says that families who want to work hard in our state, they are disincentivized from working hard because then they'll be taken off medical assistance. And this is something that I know that there is a there's a DFL senator who has a bill to work on this issue. And I just think that if we're going to continue down this path, the solution is providing the appropriate medical assistance and tax strategies so that we're not kicking people off of their health insurance, and that there is a tiered approach that allows for people to work harder and fill the many jobs that we have available, rather than a new mandate on one particular area of the state.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chairman, at your discretion and with your permission and leniency, I would like to call down the MAC gentleman who testified last time. I believe he's in the room, and just have him just kind of answer some of our questions regarding our other hubs, Midwest hubs, doing this, such as Detroit, Chicago Midway, O'Hara, and if it's such a good idea here, why not in other hubs? And my concern was, as he testified a week and a half ago, that this would affect potential Minneapolis as a hub. So I was wondering, Mr.
If he can answer quickly, and if we can ask shorter sentence questions so that we're not taking 5 minutes on a question for a yes or no answer.
Mr. Chair, my question was 30 seconds, so I appreciate that.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Chairman Nelson and committee members, thank you. Mitch Killian, Governmental Affairs with the Metropolitan Airports Commission. One thing I hope that you recognize from this conversation is there's a lot more in-depth conversation that needs to happen, and this bill didn't go to transportation, didn't go to local government, and now it's just going to the general register. So there are a lot of things we would like to react to that we're testifying to here, and we hope we get the chance to somewhere. To your question, no, none of the Midwest airports have anything like this. None of the Delta hubs, not Chicago, not Dallas. And you can look and find some weird nuances on the coast, San Francisco and New York, that have something, but not like this exactly, and that someone's going to point to, and one out of 30 hubs or a couple out of 30 hubs have something, but none of the Midwest airports that we compete against for traffic, including Delta's connecting traffic, have policies like this.
Representative McDonald.
Well, thank you, Mr. Killian. These policies are detrimental to the success of our airline, our hub. Furthermore, just because we have recognized on this side that the damage this could provide and the fact that there is health care to those who work there already, SEIU has a federal, I think they have a national welfare fund that helps every employee there. So to indicate they don't have it is false. But our concern is that, A, it's not needed because they have health care, and why they aren't accepting it, that's the bigger question. And as Mr. Killian said, this must go to other committees to be ironed out these differences. I mean, you're looking at the gentleman that basically has your livelihood. And those from Delta and MAC and other areas are telling you, including a lady who testified 2 weeks ago that has many small businesses of independent women and BIPOC people and women who have businesses there, that this will affect greatly. And yet you ignore what they say. I don't see how you can just cram this through and go bring it to the national or to the register, general register, without listening to grave concerns of people that are moving our state. And just to indicate that we don't appreciate or are thankful for those who are pushing our grandparents and our children and cleaning and doing all the work is false. And I see when you look at us saying, well, you insinuate that we don't care. We do care. We do care, and we're thankful of the good work that they do. But we also have to be concerned with those who are saying this is detrimental and costly, and it's certainly not ready for the general register, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Therefore, I do request a roll call.
Roll call being requested. There'll be a roll call. Representative Berg, you want to renew your motion as amended? Because we did adopt one amendment at the earlier meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will renew my motion as amended to send this to the general register. A few closing remarks. I will just say that there are 12 airports across the nation that use this model. I think you're misunderstanding what the union's welfare fund is for. And as far as saying that somebody controls my livelihood, I've been doing this for 20 years. I have been through mergers and bankruptcies and all the things. And I can tell you that somebody testifying whose suit costs more than the worker that you claim you care about makes in a year, that's a little skewed. So if you care about those workers, as you just said you did, I look forward to your yes vote on the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So with that, we'll take the roll on House File 4818.
Chair Nelson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Berg.
Aye.
Representative McDonald.
Nay.
Representative Daniels.
Nay.
Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Representative Hill.
Aye.
Representative Hussein.
Aye.
Representative Jordan.
Aye.
Representative Kozlowski is excused. Representative Mecklund.
Nay.
Representative Myers.
Myers is a no.
Representative Schultz.
No.
And Representative Wolgamont is excused. There are six ayes, four noes.
Five.
My mistake, five noes.
With six ayes and five noes, the motion prevails. The bill is on its way. Thank you, Representative Burke. And members, with that, with nothing else in front of us, we are adjourned.